Buglers, we are live from Leicester Square Theatre on the 16th of September with Chris Addison and Alice Fraser. It might be our only London date of the year, so get your tickets now. Oh, get them at thebuglepodcast.com. That bit's important.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the Bugle Ashes Zoltzcast. I am Andy Zoltzman, and today we look back on the first day of the second Ashes Test in the third season of the Stokes and McCullum S&M English Cricket Revolution. I'm counting two summers and one winter in that to get a nice 1-2-3 at the start of this show. Now, I write all my introductions to this show in advance of the day's play that we're looking at, so let's just find out which one is most appropriate. England won the toss at Lord's in helpful bowling conditions, and with their masterful array of high-class seam bowling artists, exploited the conditions perfectly to reduce their overconfident opponents to rubble. Didn't quite happen. Australia won the toss in helpful bowling conditions and came up against the unstoppable batting juggernauticals of the baz-ballastitious England lineup. Zach Crawley clattering six fours off Pat Cummins' first over, reducing the Australian captain to tears, before Ben Duckett repeatedly slashed the ball aerially through gully for a smorgasbord of unstoppable boundaries, taking England to lunch at 243 for... No, that didn't quite happen either.
Could do, though.
It could do. Well, could do tomorrow. Let's try another one. England won the toss in helpful bowling conditions. Chose to bat first to everyone's surprise. Zach Crawley hit the first ball of the match for a majestic four through the covers, as he simply always does. England declared immediately at four for naught, bowled Australia out in those helpful bowling conditions for just 83, as expected, and had flayed their way to a 180-run lead before declaring again 13 minutes before the close and taking a cut. No, that didn't happen either. Oh, here we go. England won the toss in helpful bowling conditions, and Australia ended up 339 for five, putting England on course to fulfil Zach Crawley's pre-match prediction of a 150-run England win. Now, to get a 150-run win, you'd think England would have to bat first, but that is how confident this Stokes-McCullum side is. They wanted to do it in a spectacular way, and to win by 150 runs in a way that will get people talking, they had to bowl first, concede a big score, then get bowled out, follow on, go massive in the second innings, set Australia 250 to win, and skittle them for 100 on day five. Absolutely bang on course. It couldn't have gone any better for England to discuss this wonderful first day on course for Zach Crawley's pre-match prediction coming true. I'm joined by producer Chris. Chris, you're going to fire me some questions about day one. It was a suboptimal day for England, given that everyone before the start of play was saying, oh yeah, this is, you've got to bowl first here.
I mean, I'm looking at the upsides of this, Andy, and I think England's spin bowling all-rounder Joe Root was clearly the star of the show.
Yes.
And that is about as far as I can go.
Yeah, I mean, that was a little bit worrying, wasn't it, given that Australia have an off-spinner who got 8 wickets in the first test, is on course for 500 wickets in his career very, very soon. And Joe Root span one about a yard and a half to have Travis Head stumped on day one.
Look, Joe Root, if he keeps going when he's 60, he can get to 500 wickets too.
Maybe his batting has just been, you know, it's locked in this, you know, England's greatest ever off-spinner. Who knows?
Yeah. I believe. Yeah. He's the spin-bowling Darren Stevens. So, Andy, talk to us about the toss. Well, this was important, right?
Well, as we predicted yesterday, Chris, the toss was absolutely crucial. It was cloudy. The lights were on for most of the day. There was a green pitch. Tuffers, who I worked with on TMS, played for Middlesex at Lord for his whole career, played for England for over a decade. He said he'd never seen a greener pitch at Lord's. It was the perfect morning to bowl first. England won that toss. dropped two catches and only got one wicket in the first session with in the last over before lunch. So the toss was crucial. Unfortunately, the first hour was then even more crucial, as was the second hour. And as I said, all the hours were crucial. So still, the toss was crucial. It just then became decrucialised by how crucial the subsequent crucial phases were.
There was another crucial moment very early on in the game. I make it the first time someone has run on the pitch in an England international since someone did a naked cartwheel between England and New Zealand 3-4 years ago.
Oh, right.
Was the crucial interruption stopped play the most crucial bit of the day?
Well, it's possible. It was after only one over. And it did bring about perhaps the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen on a cricket pitch. In Johnny Bairstow, England's wicketkeeper, who is a strong man. And, you know, I think he played quite a lot of rugby in his youth. I'm not sure which code of rugby he played, but he is a strong man. You see that when he hits the ball as if he's trying to eradicate the entire concept of spheres from the universe. He is a powerful man, and he picked up one of these protesters and just carried him over the boundary for six. That's a good sort of 70 yards up the Lord's Slope as well. He just picked him up. And they have the World Wife Carrying Competition in, I can't remember where it's in, is it in Finland or Sweden? I can't remember. We have talked about that on the main bugle, I think, in the past.
Yeah.
And maybe this could be a new angle for cricket, a protester carrying championships. It could be something that could spice up T20 cricket and the 100 if you just have a random incursion. You get an extra bonus 15 runs if you could carry the incursor off the pitch. It was totally extraordinary. And of course, it raised the question, as some statistician on the radio might have pointed out, how would Ben Foulkes have responded had he been wicketkeeper in that same situation, as probably every cricket Twitter person responded straight away. But I think more importantly is, let's not forget that if Foulkes had been picked, Bairstow would still have been in the team. So that still would have happened. He'd just have had to come from third slip instead of from wicketkeeper. He might have even done it better because he wouldn't have had pads and gloves on. But it was a truly extraordinary thing. And Johnny Bairstow is not someone that you would want to rile in any way. He is an intense man and a very, very powerful one. So it was a rather strange start to the day, and the protesters didn't get onto the pitch with their orange dust. Otherwise, the ball might have spun even more. Who knows? But it did make me think, you know, were there any other cricketers who would have dealt with it better than Bairstow? Only one springs to mind, and that was a chap called Johnny Douglas, J.W.H.T. Yes. Douglas, who was England captain at either side of the First World War. He was also Olympic boxing champion at the London Olympics in 1908. So I think he might have dealt with it, maybe not with the wrestling move that Bairstow, actually, you can't wrestle someone over 50 to 70 metres, can you? But I think he might have. He might also have done a good job.
I think one thing I'm really keen to find out, Andy, is does one of Foulkes or Bairstow drive an electric car?
Well, why is
and
that?
And did that influence Bairstow's decision?
Oh, I see, right. I don't think we can necessarily interpret that because of the way Bairstow dealt with the Just Stop Oil protester, he's therefore massively in favour of fossil fuels.
fair.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to ask him.
We talked on the preview about Josh Tung, his record against top level batters,
yes,
which I think you said wasn't particularly impressive, but that was a it was a better day for him yesterday than many of the other England
bowlers.
The
thing with stats and data is they sort of give you, they tell you what has happened and what is what's likely to happen based on that, but you get exceptions to that, and they've picked Josh Tung as a bit of a hunch that the stats didn't really suggest there was anything there. They've seen something they like in terms of the kind of bowler he is, the pace he has, the way he bowls. And he got Usman Khawaja and David Warner out. Khawaja, as he faced that ball from Josh Tung, was sitting proudly with the highest ever average as a test opener in the entire history of the game from players who've opened 15 times or more in test cricket. I think he's still top of that list despite being out. He bowled him, Khawaja left the ball that came in viciously, hit the top of the stumps. He bowled David Warner, who batted really well yesterday. And Tung bowled this over, which got an inside edge for a couple that nearly bowled him. He played and missed a ball that went over the stumps. and swung past Bairstow that was basically unplayable. And then he pitched one slightly further up that hit, swung in, went through Warner and literally knocked the top off leg stump. The stump, the top bit of the stump snapped off. It was a brilliant over and a phenomenal piece of bowling. And yeah, it did suggest that this selectorial hunch, what they've seen, could clearly work in Test cricket. He was a little inconsistent the rest of the day, still went at 4.5 and over. But they were two sensational deliveries, and that sort of gave England a foothold in the game at a point where it looked like the morning was going to be a complete disaster.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Now, the problem with him taking those wickets, particularly for the other England bowlers, was, and for all the fans in the stadium, was that it brought Smith and Labuschagne to the crease.
Yes.
So, I mean, I don't know who of those you want to focus on. maybe Steve Smith, as he is still threateningly there.
Yes. Well, he came out and he sort of flayed the ball all over the place. He reached 24 off 15 balls. Took him another few to get to 25, but it was his second fastest quarter century of his test career. And he's got a lot of quarter centuries. Wow. An underrated stat, the quarter century. But then he was given out and overturned it on review, and then sort of totally went defensive and scored, I think, 20-odd off the next 80 balls before getting a little more positive by the end. Ended up 85 in reasonable time by the end. And there were moments of frailty. I still don't think he's looking quite as impregnable as 4 years ago, but it was a extremely well-crafted innings, difficult conditions, the ball was moving basically all day, and he managed to get through it with his almost surrealist... I think he learnt to bat while studying Picasso paintings because all the angles don't quite make sense, but somehow it works as a coherent whole. So he's looking ominous. If he gets another 15 runs, it'll be his 800 in England, which will put him clear second behind Don Bradman, who had 1,100 in England, most hundreds in England by visiting players in Test cricket. Marnus Labuschagne. He's had a bit of a tricky run recently. His last 10 tests, he hasn't had 100. He's only had 2 50-plus scores. He's averaging 34, which isn't terrible, 17 innings, but he's only been out in single figures twice in those 17 innings. He's only faced less than 20 balls once. That was his Edgbaston Golden Duck in the first innings of this series. So he's been getting in, and previously when he was getting in, he wasn't getting out. His previous 25 tests before this run, average 67, 10 centuries, 12 other 50-plus scores. So whether that little bubble of intensity he had, it almost sort of burnt itself out, and he doesn't quite have the concentration, stamina. I don't know. He also got a good ball from Robinson, so it might be that he just got out. And he got a good ball from Robinson on 47. Just as on the radio, I was giving stats about how good Ollie Robinson was bowling to top-level players who were on 25 or more. So that was...
Well, there you go. Yeah. There you go. I don't want to dwell on this point, okay. Andy. Broad, Jimmy, Robbo, despite that wicket, I think I described to you as them looking tired and bad. what's going on there?
Well, they
there?
Certainly look tired, and you might have missed off the hyphen tempered after bad there. it was a strange. I've looked at the data, and it just shows how hard it is to interpret it. What does it really mean? Looking at England seamers in overs 1 to 80 when bowling first in England, 54 innings in the database, goes back to about 2006. Mm. Now, England seamers bowled 40% of their balls on a good line and length. That's 12th best of those 54 innings. They're hitting the stumps percentage, which, again, is a stat that you've got to be a little careful with, but still 13%. That was the sixth most balls that would have hit the stumps by England seamers in overs 1 to 80. They're often criticised for not bringing the stumps into play enough. So on that data, they created a 22% false shots. I remember looking up during play at one point. Mm. So it was one of those days where they didn't look great, but the data suggests they didn't bowl that badly. They just didn't have the moments of luck. And then the narrative almost takes over. So, I mean, almost the key moment of the two key moments early on, fielding errors by England. One was the drop catch by Root, very difficult, low one-handed catch. I thought, seeing it, maybe Bairstow should have gone for it as wicketkeeper. Mm. So you sort of watch one go, and generally when the slip's diving towards the wicketkeeper for a catch, you think the keeper should have got it. But on the replay, it was an unbelievable ball from Anderson that sort of started on leg stump, swung late across Khawaja, who nicked it. So Root was sort of unsighted, and Bairstow was a bit unsighted and probably shifting towards where it looked like the ball was going before it swung really late, and whilst it was sort of hidden from Bairstow by Khawaja's body. So essentially it was a ball that was too good, not just for the batter, but for the wicketkeeper and the slip fielder as well. If that stuck, then, you know, the day has a different narrative. Anderson gets a wicket. Who knows what happens after that? Mm. The cricket is full of these infinite turning points where each thing happens and each alternative narrative disappears into the ether. But I guess, so it's, I don't know, they clearly weren't great yesterday. And there's a, you know, body language and what happens later in the day slightly colours our memory of what happened at the start. So it's a bit hard to interpret. You know, they could have had a few wickets with better catching, with a bit of luck. But yeah, at the same time, they did look a little worryingly blunt at times.
Stand back, it's a stat whack.
A quick stat whack before we wrap up, Chris. The opening stand lasted 23.1 overs, 73 runs. Seven of the previous nine Lords tests have seen a wicket fall within the first 26 balls. There's been a wicket within the first five overs in 11 of the last 19. Seven of the last 10, the team batting first, have been bowled out for under 190. So 339 for five on a cloudy day is significantly suboptimal. Broad and Anderson had no wickets in the first 80 overs of a test innings in England for only the second time since Lords 2015, when ominously Steve Smith got a double century. Australia scored a massive 501 by an enormous amount. That's counting innings where between them they've bowled at least 20 overs. England won the toss and bowled for the 105th time. It's only the 8th time that their opponents have got to 300 with three or fewer wickets down. As they were before those two wickets fell towards the end, at a point where it looked like Travis Head was going to break a significant number of records for fast scoring for Australia at Lords and even in England. Joe Root took two wickets in an over for the first time in a home test match. And, yeah, Josh Tung bowling out the Australian openers. This was my favourite stat of the day. It was the first time an England bowler has bowled out, as in hit the stumps, of both Australian openers since John Snow in 1968 at Headingley, and the only other time an England bowler has bowled both Australian openers out at Lords was in the first ever test at Lords in 1884. The bowler then, the legendary Ted Peat. And ominously, Chris, for teams batting first at Lords and scoring 350-plus, which, unless England can take the last five wickets for 10 this morning, they will. Those team 52 times, 29 wins, 21 draws, only two defeats. So for England to win from here, even with Zach Crawley's prediction, it's going to take something truly extraordinary.
Thanks, Andy.
Well, it's a pleasure. One just note of optimism, Chris, before we leave. Last year at Trent Bridge against New Zealand, the second game of the Baz Ballistic Revolution, England won the toss, chose to bowl. New Zealand ended the day 318 for four, not far off what Australia are currently. Went on to score 553, and England won that game. So, okay. Again, bang on course. I mean, it's probably a better bowling attack. The balls are probably not quite as stodgy as they were last year, and the pitch is not as flat as that one. But other than that, as I said, bang on course. Thank you for listening to the Bugle Ashes Zoltzcast. We'll be back with a review of Day 2 and a look ahead to Day 3. Between Day 2 and Day 3. Goodbye.